We've gotten a robust discussion going in recent years about the American dream and how it feels like that's out of reach to people in many parts of the country. The idea that each generation will accomplish more than the last, academically, economically, you name it, has taken some dents and dings, and not just in the Rust Belt, the old industrial heartland. Nicholas Kristof is from Yamhill, Oregon, far from the Rust Belt. He and his writing partner and wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, examined the fate of people who once saw a bright future in front of them when they were kids. Wu Dunn and Kristof's book is Tightrope, Americans Reaching Out for Hope. Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times. Cheryl Wu Dunn currently works in finance and consulting. Together, they wrote four previous books together. They are the first husband and wife to share a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of China back in 1990. Nicholas Kristof won a second Pulitzer in 2006 for his columns on Darfur. Nicholas Kristof, good to have you on The Exchange.
Good to be with you.
Hello. Yes.
Cheryl Wu Dunn, good to have you as well, yes.
Yes.
So there's lots of interest in this subject area, certainly. I think that was demonstrated with J.D. Vance and Hillbilly Elegy years ago. What started you guys?
Well, we were traveling around the world covering humanitarian crises abroad, and then we'd periodically come back to Yamhill, Oregon. My mom is still on the family farm there. I've obviously got a lot of very close friends there. And we saw a humanitarian crisis unfolding in slow motion in Yamhill. And, you know, at first we didn't really know how to process it because a quarter of the kids on my old school bus, the number 6 school bus, have died from drugs, alcohol, and suicide. And I mean, it was just very hard to understand. And then we gradually came to see that this is a nationwide problem, that life expectancy as a whole for the entire country fell for 3 years in a row, and that in a sense there's a great depression that is afflicting much of the country, even as the overall, you know, even as corporate profits are soaring, the stock markets have done very well, and so on.
We have heard that information before, the deaths of despair, the fact that the American life expectancy actually dipped for several years in a row there. We've heard some of these numbers, stagnating wages as well. But Cheryl, you guys quote the negative experience index. What's that?
Well, what we are looking at, there are a whole bunch of data points that are critical to understanding more beyond the GDP growth rate and the stock market. And so I think it's really important to look at a variety of indicators. And, you know, the U.S. is no more number one in many areas that we think of ourselves as the best in the world. And a lot of these indicators are symptoms of the struggles that the working class people face. So, for instance, you know, when we think of, you know, access to clean water, we're actually number 44. There are people in this country who do not have access to clean water. So just think about something as basic as that. And access to internet. We take the internet for granted. You know, Al Gore invented the internet, right? An American did, but we're like number 46. So this is a symptom that, you know, there are so many Americans out there who are, you know, basically living in, you know, in the conditions of the developing world. And so that's why there's this primal scream for something. They want a change. And, you know, what we saw in Yamhill was reflected in reporting that we did in other parts of the country as well.
Well, where it is just hard to get ahead, which makes me question the book title. What do you mean by tightrope?
Well, it seemed to us that there are plenty of people in America who grow up in upper middle class or in affluent circumstances from educated parents, and their life trajectory is sort of walking along a nice path. They're unlikely to slip, and if they do, it'll be quite easy to pick themselves up. On the other hand, if you're from a working class background, and in particular from families that have been wrestling in recent years with issues of addiction or poverty, then you're on a tightrope. And I mean, you know, one of our friends, he described himself as his tightrope, he said, was made of fish line. And it's a lot easier to slip. And if you do, there's no safety net.
So the first story that you guys tell in the book is about neighbors you had in Yamhill, the Knapp family, with an alcoholic, abusive father, Gary, who beat the mother, Dee. But as you point out, that even when she was fleeing for her life, what it felt like from her husband, she had hope for her five kids for the future. And what ended up happening?
Yeah, the five Knapp kids, Farlan was my grade. And then his brother Zeelan and his brother Nathan, the brother Keelan, and their sister Regina, they got on the number 6 bus right after I did. And because Mr. Knapp had a good union job laying pipe, and their mom had a good job driving tractor, so they had moved up in the world, and they'd they bought their own home. And then the kids all struggled to find good jobs. When Farlan was fired from his job, he went into a downward spiral. He self-medicated with drugs and alcohol. He died of liver failure as a result. His brother Zeelan died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. His brother Nathan blew himself up cooking meth. And their sister Regina died of hepatitis from injecting drugs. And the only survivor was the baby, Keelan, and he survived only because he was spending 13 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary, and that proved protective.
Wow. So of the five kids, one survives, and Dee is still alive, the mother?
That's right. Mrs. Knapp is still going strong, actually. She came out to New York for the launch of Tightrope, and every day she walks up the hill and visits the gravesites of four of her five children.
Nick, what made the future seem bright in Yamhill in the early 70s, and what made it vanish?
Well, people had done very, very well. There were a lot of people at that time who had grown up with very limited education, in homes without electricity or running water, and then had been able to get good blue-collar jobs, union jobs that really put them on a path toward the middle class. And then the GI Bill of Rights, for example, helped them get an education, helped them buy homes. And so there was, I think just about everybody when I was a kid was doing way better, every family was doing way better than they had a generation earlier. And it was largely because of those, good blue-collar jobs, good union jobs. One of my very close friends, the Greens, whom we write about in Tightrope, their dad had a job as a cement finisher and had helped work on the Fremont Bridge in Portland. And it was a real source of pride for him that he'd helped build that bridge, and they'd earned a good living doing so.
So Cheryl Wu Dunn, the people who have a much narrower path now, we're talking about the tightrope, how are they viewed by the people who still have a wider path? I mean, basically, what do the people who are getting places feel about what are their attitudes toward the people who are on that tightrope?
Well, I think that is the big question of our nation right now. We have a small group of people who is basically partying on the deck of the ship, whereas many people below deck are looking at this hole that is actually expanding. And ultimately, when part of the ship has a problem with it, it's going to affect the whole ship. And so the question is whether or not the people at the top, there's an incredible amount of share of wealth that the top 1% have. It's grown over the past 30, 40 years, almost doubled, whereas the share of the bottom 50% of national wealth has basically, been cut in half. So it's not a tiny amount of people who are in that, the bottom part of the ship. I mean, there's a large swath of those people. And so we need to start paying attention to them. I think we see what happened with their frustration in politics with the election of Trump.
Well, are we still in Dickens mode? I mean, if you're poor, it's your fault?
This is one of the biggest problems. You put your finger on it. The whole narrative of personal responsibility that, you dig your grave, you dig your hole. If you want to get out, you have to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. In fact, that nomenclature is very strange because, first of all, it's impossible to physically pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But somehow in the 1970s and 1980s, it came to mean this is what you have to do, that it moved from the definition of the impossible to this is what you were supposed to do. And that meant that, you know, there was no need for the government to help you because you had to do it yourself. And more, what's even worse is that it meant people internalized that perception, and so they start blaming themselves for all the bad decisions that they make. And absolutely, we have to be responsible for ourselves. That is so, you know, we're not going to absolve people of their own personal responsibility, but it shouldn't be 100% on them. I mean, we are, you know, born and raised in a context, in an environment, and, you know, what happens to us is also just largely dependent upon what's going on in our environment.
So a lot of blame has been thrown around in recent years, you know, blame Mexico, blame China. I mean, how do you apportion any, I mean, what happened to the system here? Who broke the system? And therefore, who should, you know, where's the pressure to rectify things?
Well, it's striking that young Americans tend to blame capitalism. And among young Americans, there's actually a higher approval rating for socialism than for capitalism. And I don't quite buy that because in the post-World War II period, we had interval from 1945 through the 1970s where capitalism worked incredibly well, and it was very good both at growing the pie and at dividing it. And then in the 1970s, a number of things went wrong. I think that part of it was Nixon's Southern strategy, which ended up racializing the issue of investing in human capital and investing in benefit programs. I think part of it was President Reagan's narrative that government is inevitably a source of the problem. It can never do anything right. And we ended up, you know, look, the economy, I think, genuinely needed a kick in the pants, and it needed a certain amount of deregulation. But I think we went way too far. I think we went way too far in reallocating power from labor unions to corporations. And in particular, we adopted these narratives that you and Terrell were talking about, that it's all about personal responsibility, in ways that I think led the government to neglect issues of investing in the next generation.
And so, Jeff, you talk about blame, and I know that people, you know, feel more comfortable trying to find the culprit in something.
Sure.
And a lot of what we're arguing is that there's no single person, single culprit. There's no silver bullet as a result that will actually fix everything. It's a lot of little things. It's kind of like the way we addressed car safety. You know, there were a huge number of car crashes, you know, decades and decades ago, and there wasn't, you know, you couldn't build one car that would withstand every single crash. What you had to do was, you know, you had to, you know, add seatbelts, and then you had to have airbags, and then you had to have padded dashboards. And so I think that's the kind of approach we need to take, is that there are a lot of little areas where we have to address these problems.
Cheryl Wu-Dunn and Nicholas Kristof are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, Pulitzer Prize-winning authors working together again on a book called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. So the success sequence, what is that, Cheryl?
That is a very interesting approach that sort of basically argues that if you do three things, then you won't be in poverty. So, and those three things are: you have to graduate from high school, you have to get a full-time job, and you have to have your kids after you get married. And when they've done research on this, they've discovered that of people who actually follow all those three things, only 2% are in poverty. And of people who don't follow any of those three things, 79% are in poverty. So the whole idea is that let's follow these three things. And, you know, a lot of conservatives says this, you know, let's follow these three things and then you'll be fine. The problem is that there are so many things that get in the way. Even high school, graduating high school, already one in six, one in seven Americans does not graduate from high school. So we need to do things to keep people in high school, especially when they're having troubles at home. If you're living in a chaotic household where there's violence and abuse, that's really hard for you to, you know, focus on your schoolwork and stay in school and even understand that school is important. So that's where we need to have support systems that help these people, counseling or, you know, vocational education that actually allows them, if they're not going to go to college, at least develop some skills where they can actually get a job when they leave high school.
Yeah, you point out several times over that the big factor in falling behind for a lot of people is having kids when they didn't intend to have kids. And you point out, too, that our teens have sex at about the same rates as kids in Europe. But what's the difference?
Yeah, the difference is that European kids get much better access to comprehensive sex education, and then especially to reliable forms of birth control. So it's not that American kids are, you know, have more hormones or are more dissolute. It's an issue of public policy. And so that's an interesting example of how, you know, of course this does relate to personal responsibility. And so, you know, by all means, let's have the conversation about personal responsibility. But if we have that conversation, like, we've also got to talk about our collective social responsibility.
Which is to educate kids a little better on what happens when you have sex.
Yeah, and to provide them with reliable forms of birth control. And, you know, some studies show that every dollar put into such programs pays for itself seven times over. You know, we as a society, we're willing to pay $17,000 for a Medicaid childbirth, but we're reluctant to pay a few hundred dollars for a reliable implant or IUD for a girl who wants it.
And so the result is that in the U.S., you know, teenage girls have babies at three times the rate that their counterparts in Europe do.
Wow. So I guess one of the more shocking parts of the early part of the book, Tightrope, is where you find parallels with the late Soviet Union here in the United States.
Yes, that's actually rather disturbing because obviously in the Soviet Union, they had a problem with alcoholism, and it was just so widespread. But it was a symptom of deeper problems in the society and in the government. So we don't want to follow their route because ultimately what they ended up doing is just stopped publishing the statistics.
Wow. Just so, yeah, the statistics don't look bad if you're
not
get
a
to
good
see
solution.
Them. No, it is not. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Pulitzer Prize winning authors, husband and wife, the only husband and wife team ever win the Pulitzer. Nick also won another one for his columns on Darfur. Their book together, the latest book together, is called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, in which Nick explores his background in Yamhill, Oregon, and they investigate other parts of the country as well. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone 800-838-3760 by email jx@jeffnet.org. I find myself coming back fairly often to thinking of Mark Levinson's book, An Extraordinary Time, which says that the post-war boom may have been the anomaly and that what we have now is the more common economy. Does that register with either of you that way?
You know, there's a big debate about this, and I think we don't fully know. But I push back at the idea that was, you know, something that could, that was gone forever, that it was inevitable that automation and globalization would cause problems. Because, look, I mean, Canada went through that same issue of globalization, automation. So did Germany. So did the rest of the world. And those countries haven't seen full-on life expectancy. Those countries didn't lose 68,000 people a year to drug overdoses. So I do think that in some fundamental way, this is not because of inevitable larger economic forces, but it's because of bad policy, policy decisions that we as a country made that other countries did not.
Let's talk about some of those then. I mean, what were some of the things? You mentioned deregulation, some of which had to happen, as we point
right.
out. But what are some of the other things that happened that began to spread the distance between people who had money and people who don't?
So in the 1980s, the war on drugs and the two major pieces of legislation that basically embodied the war on drugs and the mass incarceration was really detrimental to society. So that meant that small-time, you know, drug users or small-time, you know, drug mules, people who just, you know, carried little bits of drugs around, got thrown into long jail sentences. So we write about Geneva Cooley in Tightrope, and she was a woman who was living in New York, addicted to drugs for many years, and took a train to Alabama to meet a friend of hers, And, you know, she was caught, and they threw her in jail and ended up sentencing her to 999 years without parole.
Wow.
You know, one woman, she was African-American, she was put in jail, just like thousands of others who were like her put in jail. In the meantime, you had these drug, you know, pharma companies who had far more of a negative influence on opioid addiction and opioid deaths. I mean, by, you know, basically pushing opioids on doctors who then prescribed them and then got people addicted and, you know, got people who ended up overdosing. And they're sitting with billions of dollars in their bank accounts, whereas so many of these people like Geneva Cooley are in jail. So that's being changed, but all of the family breakups that it caused and the you know, pain for millions of families around the country for many, many years, that's very devastating to not only those families, obviously, but also to society.
I noticed, Cheryl, that you asked the Sacklers, the family of people who made OxyContin, for a comment. How did that go over?
Right. They conveniently decided not to comment.
Huh. Not a big surprise.
You know, they made $13 billion as a fortune, you know, as the company was marketing opioids in a reckless way that was not tolerated in other countries. And, you know, pharma companies were really allowed to act like Colombian drug lords with no check. And I just think that's an example of how we went way too far in deregulation.
So let's talk about another name from Yamhill, Nick. Kevin Green. How did he fall behind?
So Kevin was the son of the cement finisher I mentioned who helped build the Fremont Bridge. His sister, Cindy, was my year in school, and Kevin was a year behind. He ran track and cross country with him. Also very good friends with their younger brother, Clayton. And they all kind of, they just struggled to get good jobs. Kevin, he bounced around from job to job, but he never found a good union job that would earn him a good living the way his dad had. And as a result, his girlfriend, the mother of his twin sons, left him, and he was he self-medicated with drugs and alcohol, and he kind of slipped into a miasma of depression, of low self-esteem, of loneliness. And he ended up very obese. Cindy died first, then Kevin, and then a year ago, Clayton did as well. And the oldest, Tom Jr., had already died. So again, another family with four or five kids who have passed away, even as their mom, Irene, is going strong. And the great-grandmother, Irene's mom, only died a year or two ago in her 90s.
It's interesting how, you know, money accrues interest when you have it, and debt seems to pile on when you've got that. I mean, when you describe cases like Kevin Green's, it seems like the system piles it on. You get debt, you get garnished wages, you lose your driver's license, all this stuff seems to pile on.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And it really starts with just not being able to get a high school education. I mean, he saw his, you know, these you know, in our generation, they when we were young, they saw their parents getting great jobs with, you know, through with union wages without having a high school graduation, you know, diploma. And so that led them to believe, oh, well, I can do it too. I don't need education. And so if there was not a focus on education in the family, that meant, okay, well, you know, no need to stay in here. But obviously in the modern world, it just didn't work that way, and you needed a high school education at least. And so that's why their generation fell so far behind. And there is a greater appreciation nowadays for these types of, you know, sort of pylons. In Illinois, for instance, the governor gave an amnesty for those people who had their driver's license suspended for reasons like, oh, court fees or other things that, you know, not having to do with, like, drunken driving or anything like that. And so there's a growing recognition that, you know, this compilation of things that really hurt people's ability to thrive, is getting in the way, and that we need to start doing something about it. We need to start doing a lot more about it.
I haven't mentioned the main themes of the book so far. Theme one is that working class communities are suffering. Theme two is that the suffering in those communities is a result of decisions made in the past. Theme three, the challenges are not insurmountable. But guys, we have been here before, haven't we? With a vast underclass far below people who are filthy, stinking rich.
The Gilded Age, yes. Basically, it is the second Gilded Age. I mean, it's really the disparities. It's been well documented, the disparities in wealth. And the share of national income, the changes in that are one really main indication. If you look at the percentage of the top 1% who owns about 10% of the national wealth in the national income in the 1980s, now they've basically doubled that to about 20%, whereas the bottom 50% share of national income in 1980, they had about 22%, and now that's in half, about 13% now. So you've seen this shrinking of a huge part of, we're talking about 50% of the national income, the bottom half. That's a huge amount of people. And it's being felt pretty broadly.
Let's get a phone call in here. Anne in Eugene is calling. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Cheryl Wu Dunn and Nicholas Kristof.
I had poverty in my childhood, and now at 77, I have what is for me a comfortable retirement. I'll tell you how I fight poverty. One way is by contributing to Planned Parenthood. And the other way is by contributing to Project Prevention, which gives addicts $300 and for getting the money is in addition to giving them either long-term birth control or sterilization. And it's open to either men or women. And frankly, I can't think of a worse start than being the child of an addict, because that child is abused even before it's born. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Anne. Appreciate it. Thoughts from you guys?
There actually is one baby born every 15 minutes with exposure to opioids. It is very true. That's a very terrible situation. And that's why we need to focus on early childhood education. Nowadays you can predict the trajectory of a baby based on where he was born, the zip code. And if you look at some counties, there's one, Shannon County in South Dakota, where a baby born there actually has a lower life expectancy than a baby born in Bangladesh or Cambodia. So that means that, we can't fault the babies for, their trajectories. We do need to give them support. And early childhood education is extremely important as a way to actually lift babies out and address some of the challenges that they face when they're very young.
That seems
other,
to be... Go ahead.
One other thought that goes to Anne's comment. I think one thing that conservatives basically got right over the last 50 years was the importance of family structure to kids, and that intact families really do lead boys in particular to have better outcomes on average. But the conservative prescription was essentially to tell people to value families and kind of promote marriage and this kind of thing. And that did not seem to work very well. But two things do seem to help. And one is to give young people access to better earning jobs. So vocational training programs, for example, that put people in higher earning jobs, those are more likely to result in stronger two-parent families when they have kids. And the other is what Anne was talking about, which is helping disadvantaged teenagers avoid unwanted pregnancies. And if those girls can avoid a pregnancy and having a baby at 16 or 17, then they're more likely in their 20s to have planned children in the context of marriage in a way that is good for everybody.
Well, and then I was about to say that that was the big message that comes through in the book is that help kids even before they're born, as Ann talks about here. But there's a lot of stuff that can be done here. Education, we've mentioned several times, so that comes through loud and clear. Let's talk about Tani Adewumi in New York City. How did school help him?
So Tani was an immigrant kid, a refugee from Nigeria, and he's in a homeless shelter in New York City, goes to a school that has a chess club, and his mom he's got a great family, and his mom asks if the fees can be waived for him to join the chess club. He's never played chess, and he turns out to be just an unbelievable chess player. And so in the course of a year, his chess rating soared. He practiced nonstop, and the school coach was very supportive of him. And a year after he began playing chess, he won the New York State Chess Championship for his age group while living in a homeless shelter. And, you know, I watched him walk down the street with this trophy just about as big as he was. And it was, it was truly inspiring to see. It was a reminder that talent is universal, but opportunity is not.
And so the school did eventually help him, and the community as well. I mean, helped him and his family get into a home, didn't they?
That's right. It was heartwarming in every which way. So I wrote about him, and there was a GoFundMe that ended up raising $250,000 for the family. They people also donated a home for the family, and they provided jobs for the parents, as well as just a library of chess books for Tani. And then what was really remarkable was that the family as a whole, they decided not to take this $250,000, even though they were homeless and, you know, recent refugees, and instead to use that money to start a foundation to help other newly arrived refugees who had nothing. And it was just such a noble gesture of kind of paying it forward. It was truly America at its best.
Wow. Let's talk about some justice efforts, too. I mean, you'd already told us, Cheryl, about Geneva Cooley and her 999 years for being an accidental drug mule. You also take us to Tulsa, where you find a lot of people locked up for not paying fines, but there's also the Women in Recovery program there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Women in Recovery is an example of a solution that actually should be scaled across the country. What it does is it looks at people who are destined for jail, so women in particular, because it's women in recovery, and if the underlying cause of their criminality is their addiction, they work very closely with the courts and with the jails, and they say, okay, we'll take this woman if she is interested in doing so, and we'll put her into our program. It's about a 16-month program. It's extremely intense. They have to commit to it every single day. It's like 10 hours a day. It's a huge commitment. But they undergo all sorts of therapy because this program recognizes that what really needs to happen is that these people have to be weaned off of drugs. It's not, putting them in jail or in prison for many years is not going to solve the problem. So what they do is they detox them, they have give them medical treatment, they give them psychotherapy and counseling. They also give them job training and, just training on how to get your life back together, household finances. And ultimately they get them an apprenticeship and they get them a job. They talk to employers in the area to see if they will hire, ex-felons, and they've gotten a whole cluster of employers who are willing to do that, and so they can place these women. So 2 years later, these women are basically productive members of society. So overall, this program, during the years that they have been in existence, which is like 7 or 8 years, they've saved the community $70 million, in court fees and health care costs and in prison costs. It's really a win-win.
So we do move away, slowly but surely, it seems like, from the lock them up and throw away the key attitude. If anybody had a right to feel that people should be locked up forever, it's Debbie Bagri, who was shot by a guy named Ian Manuel. And yet, what have they done with their lives?
another inspiring example. Debbie is a woman in Tampa, Florida, who was going out with some friends a year after the birth of her child, and walking to her car, she was shot in the face by a 13-year-old kid named Ian Manuel. And this case immediately became sort of sensational because Debbie is a, you know, pretty middle-class white woman. Ian was a black kid who had a long list of charges already. Ian was sentenced to, even though he was 13 years old, he was charged as an adult and was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. From prison at Christmas, his first year in, he called her collect. So Debbie gets this. She's home. She gets this collect call from prison from Ian Manuel, and she accepts it and says, you know, Ian, why did you shoot me? And they begin, and he apologizes, and they begin to form something of a friendship. And then she argues for him to be released early. He is eventually released, and he is now starting over in New York, partly because of the compassion that Debbie showed him.
Wow, that is an amazing story. There's a great couple of sentences in the book that I want to read that go like this. In researching this book, we have discovered much money wasted subsidizing yachts, golf courses, or private jets. But what has made our journey through America more painful has been to witness the waste of America's most important resource, its people. So that's one of the main themes, again, of tightrope Americans reaching for hope. You interesting things here, too, about the economic part of it. Labor is the superior of capital, you think might be coming from Karl Marx. It comes from Abraham Lincoln. You do write about people, poor white people who voted for Donald Trump, Nick. You checked in with Dave Pieper, a friend in Yamhill. He's been homeless 7 times, so he's needed help. What did he tell you about what's going on with his life and why he felt the way he did?
Dave is an old friend of mine. He lives down the road, and he believes that that Donald Trump is the answer to the problem, to his problems. He's also a very strong gun rights believer. I think that also shapes his decision. But in general, you know, Yamhill is both in considerable distress and voted for President Trump. And you know, if you look at Oregon, Oregon from about Roseburg south. And Eastern Oregon has all been in great economic distress, and this is also, much of it is Trump country, you know, maybe with the exception of Ashland. And I think that part of that is this yearning, you know, there's this desperation, and the counties where there were more deaths of despair from drugs, alcohol, and suicide were those counties where Trump did relatively better than Mitt Romney had done 4 years earlier. And I think that this sense of lives falling apart, that a system that has abandoned them, is part of that.
So Cheryl Wu, Donna, I'm still trying to struggle with how to word this as a question, because I'm still struggling with the concept. But it's basically that we fail as individuals and think that we would only succeed as individuals. But as it seems like you point out in case after case, we do a lot better when we work together.
Absolutely, and I think that's what we have to change. You know, we have to change the attitudes that people have, so that, you know, it's not that, you know, you need to strive only by yourself and in isolation of everyone else. That we actually have to work much more collaboratively, and in a society where we actually can be proud to be part of the society. And I think the other issue is that we want to make sure that we lift up as many Americans as possible so that we actually can compete in the global stage. I mean, I think that part of it is when you look at China and India, 1.4 billion people in China, nearly 1.4 billion people in India, that's a lot of people power. And so if we don't start, thinking about each one of our, you know, people here in America, all Americans, reaching their full potential, we're just not going to be able to compete.
Jeffrey, can I give an example?
Just a couple seconds left, but go ahead.
So when I was growing up in Yamhill, there was a girl in Ashland who you will know, Ann Curry.
Yeah.
And so she was not planning to go to college. She's the oldest of five kids. Nobody in her family had gone to college. And at Ashland High School, English teacher named Hattie Converse basically nudged Ann to go to college. A place in Medford gave her a scholarship. And that transformed Ann's life, and we all benefited as a result. So that's what we need to institutionalize, so it's not just up to one teacher in one hallway.
The book is called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, thank you so much. That's today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.